The Whole Health Cure with Dr. Sharon Berquist, the podcast that brings you inspiration and skills for living a healthy and fulfilled life.
Welcome to the Whole Health Cure podcast, a space for science-based conversations with renowned researchers and pioneers in nutrition, exercise, stress, resilience, mindfulness, and connection for optimizing health and longevity. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a board-certified internal medicine physician, associate professor at Emory University, and scientist specializing in well-being and longevity. Over the past three decades, I've worked with thousands of people improving their health and longevity, and on this podcast, we're dedicated to giving you all the information you need for achieving whole health naturally. We may have heard a lot about gut microbiome, and in the last decade, there's been an explosion of work focusing on the importance of the gut microbiome to our health. However, we haven't spent as much time, at least on this podcast, talking about the importance of protecting a baby's microbiome and its link to common childhood ailments. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Meenal Lele, who's the author of The Baby and the Biome. She's also the founder and CEO of Little Mixins, an early allergen introduction solution. Meenal has been a medical researcher for 20 years and has a chemical engineering and business degree from University of Pennsylvania. Meenal is focused on bringing an end to the food allergies that affect 40 million Americans, like her son. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. It's awesome to chat with you. I'm a little bit intimidated. I feel like you're going to know way more about this than me.
Oh, hardly. And again, I think talking about the application of the microbiome for baby and infant health is really an area that I think is just, there's so much to explore there. And I personally think you've done it beautifully in your book. But before diving in, I want to back up and talk about how you got interested, because you have a very strong personal connection to this topic. So yeah, tell us your story.
Yeah, my story, like so many others, starts from your own experience. My own son developed a whole host of issues that, you know, were not common childhood ailments 30, 40 years ago. And today, unfortunately, are incredibly common child ailments. But I had always assumed this wouldn't affect us because we, you know, don't have genetic predispositions for these things. And I was, you know, quote, doing everything right by the book. You know, the sort of what to expect when you're expecting book and the AAP's guidelines and things like that. And really what happened is, so as you mentioned, I've been working in the medical space on the industry side for 20 years, and I do read a lot of journals. And it's the interesting thing about reading journals is that there's always so much information in every paper. And so you can go back and read the same paper 10 times and get different information out of it. And as I started to learn more about my son's immune issues, one day I kind of, and I remember this sticking out, this whole idea of Staph aureus, people talking about Staph aureus on the skin and how it's related to eczema and food allergy development. And I was like, what is this? And I started kind of pulling at the thread. And it turns out, you know, every paper on this was talking about, you know, the bacterial influences and how the microbiome was playing into it. And the more I pieced it together, the more and more I read, it just became so clear that everyone would sort of been circling the hoop, you know, and slowly realizing that, oh my gosh, we've been talking about genetic predispositions, but that's like pale in comparison to when we think about the microbial influences on a child's propensity for, you know, likelihood of developing disease. And so, yeah, that's sort of how I got to this. And once I really realized how much the immunology community had, they were basically all in agreement that the child, the infant microbiome was a huge part of why they were developing these diseases. And I was like, wait, but nobody's telling any parents. Like, how come you guys are all like totally settled on this issue? But you talk to the normal parent, they're like, what are you talking about? I've never heard this, right? So really, that's how I got to this. And the goal of the book was to try and bridge that, you know, bridge that gap.
You know, and Meenal, I'm listening to your story, and I think of all the parents who may not have your research background, right, who wouldn't be able to necessarily delve through the literature and do the research on their own, and how important it is that this information gets communicated. I mean, I see it in internal medicine a lot, too, where what is being published in a journal and where there's consensus on what contributes to health just somehow doesn't make it into guidelines or regular practice. So such an important topic. And again, so wonderful that you have invested so much of yourself so that other parents can benefit from what you've learned.
One thing I want to say quickly, you know, I think that term, you did your own research, has taken on a whole new meaning in the last couple of years. And so one of the things I want to be clear about is that, yes, I did read a lot of medical journals, but no, I'm not an MD. And so what I really had was not access to the journal so much, but access to a whole lot of doctors who I was working with in various fields of medicine. So I could read a paper, try and summarize it, and then ask someone. I could call and say, hey, do you have a colleague that I can ask, did I interpret this correctly? You know, and that was a really critical piece. It's like, I can read the papers, but again, without the degree, I still do 100% of the time rely on a whole host of doctors to say, am I interpreting this correctly? Is this really what you and all your colleagues believe? How much is this opinion? How much is this settled? So anyway, I think that's an important piece to note.
Well, it's important really even for people in the field, right? Because there's so much complexity to interpreting a medical journal finding and putting it in the context of what is known about a topic, right? And I think sometimes when there's, say, a smaller study, maybe not randomized or a different type of way that it's designed, it makes all the difference, right, in how much conclusions we can derive from it. So I think your point is a really good one. And even amongst people in science and in medicine, there's sometimes hard to get consensus based on how studies are interpreted. So that's actually a very good point. And so you started doing this work and getting guidance from the people that you had access to. What were the misconceptions that you started encountering?
So the one that drives me crazy, and it was really the crux of why I wrote this book, is the idea that immune conditions, or allergic diseases specifically, and autoimmune conditions are genetic. And I can't tell you the number of even allergists that my child has seen. And they say, well, yeah, you know, they're sort of genetic. And I'm like, come on, that makes no sense. How could something not exist a generation ago and be in 30% of children today, and you're trying to tell me it's genetic? Perhaps you don't know what genetics means. And I'm not saying there's zero genetic predisposition to things. There's never one X turns into Y, right? It's a host of different things happening. And so, you know, that's really where this all started, was like, that was the biggest misconception. And the reason that's such a critical misconception is, think about it from a patient's perspective. If you tell me that I have an 80% chance of developing breast cancer, I'm just going to live my life. YOLO this, because, hey, I'm going to get breast cancer anyway. I didn't do anything about preventing brown hair, right? And so if you tell a parent it's genetic, and then in the next sentence you try and tell them, hey, you can prevent food allergies, hey, you can prevent eczema, there's a conflict there, because we don't prevent genetic issues, right? So we have to frame issues that are preventable as environmentally caused, because otherwise it makes no sense. And to me, that's the crux of almost all of the other misconceptions. Because once you understand allergic disease and even most autoimmune conditions as the consequence of a series of actions, decisions, maybe things that are in your control and not in your control, now we can talk about, what should we do about this? Can we reverse this epidemic?
Yeah. And as you differentiate between the two and realize that there's more to genetics, and as you got more into the topic, what were kind of, you said that led into other misconceptions. This was the crux. What were the subsequent things?
So with food allergy prevention, right, we know that early allergen introduction, the idea of feeding children foods that they might develop allergies to from before 6 months old through their first birthday, can dramatically, in some cases, 80, 90% reduce their risk of a food allergy, right? If that's true, that's clearly not genetic.
Right.
But you can't get a parent to do it if you're telling them it's genetic, right? Once I tell them, it's different. And, you know, we've understood this forever. In the 70s and 80s, we used to really, really believe, like, children are just going to grow up however they grow up. Some are just going to be bad seeds. Some are going to be great. Some are natural born readers and some are not, right? But we understand today that actually the early influences on a child, how, what the traumas they face, how they're educated, all these things. Actually, you can take almost any kid and make them a good reader, right? But it's like that. And the other big thing is, you know, skincare, because eczema and skin, your skin issues are some of the first that develop and are usually the canaries in the coal mine of other immune conditions happening, you know, subsurface. And I mean, I guess that's because we could see our skin probably. Maybe there were other things going on in our gut, but we just can't see it. But, you know, same thing is like, we want parents to really think about how they're treating their child's skin, making sure they're protecting that barrier rather than depleting it. You know, if we want parents to be judicious about antibiotic use or not use antibacterials all over their house, they need to understand that that's a choice that has influences. It's not just no matter what, sort of, you know, no matter what you eat, no matter what you put on your countertops, you're going to get the disease or not. Right. But so we can make all these other suggestions once we accept that these environmental influences really matter. And those are some of the biggest, right? Protecting our infant skin, getting them, the, you know, the foods that, to train their tolerance to an adult diet, and really avoiding unnecessary antibiotic use.
Yeah. And I want to take a step back and kind of link what you had just said about everything that your colleagues and immunologists and people that you were talking to, there was consensus on. So can you talk a little bit about how the understanding of what leads to eczema allergies, like how that's changed and how your understanding changed, not just around the genetics, but around what parents can do to reduce the burden of some of these illnesses?
I think an important way to think of this is, I don't know how much our understanding of eczema and allergy and stuff has changed so much as it's clarified, right? Because we have the ability to test and study cells that we couldn't 15 years ago, right? Like we can do basophil activation tests that weren't possible even 5 years ago. We can, you know, we can understand how people's T cells are regulating. We couldn't do that 10 years ago. So we couldn't even have the discussion about what does it mean to regulate your immune system until we could actually see. You know, it's almost like we're pre to Van Leeuwenhoek, right? Who's like figured out cells, and then, you know, like pre Fleming figuring out, you know, pre Koch, I guess maybe is the way to say it, right? Like before there was germ theory, we couldn't talk about this stuff. So it's really just slowly getting more and more clarified. And the consensus is that there's this massive interplay between the microbiome as we understand it. Again, so the microbiome being this whole host of bacteria, funguses, viruses is what I was trying to say, that live on us and in us. So on our skin and every fold, all these things as a sum. It's a giant ecosystem. And they are a big part of us. And so our immune system, everyone has an immune system, right? I like to think of your immune system as your second brain. Because very similar to your brain, you're born with a lot of the tools, but how it adapts, what it actually learns over time is part of what you experience, right? It's based on what you experience. And so these things, so we knew that children's immune systems were growing and they were adapting in a very maladaptive way compared to people 50 years ago, 30 years ago. And so that was the first level of understanding. Okay. There's clearly something going wrong here. We shouldn't be allergic to everything. And then the second layer is, you know, why is that happening? And we've really started to understand how certain environmental triggers are pushing our immune system into this sort of like hypersensitive state, this pro-inflammatory state. But simultaneously, you know, the shifts in our microbiomes, those microbes control our immune system to a large extent, or they interplay, maybe is a better word. They interplay with our immune system constantly. And so as we shift that microbiome, it's changing how our immune system behaves. And so, you know, then, you know, of course, the next big question is, what do we do about it? Right? So it's first, you're like, we don't know what's going on. Then we slowly spend 20 years figuring out what's the actual problem. And then, you know, but then we're maybe 30 years away from actually figuring out how to fix it all. So, but that's the progress of science.
Absolutely. And talking about what shapes the microbiome for babies and infants, can you kind of walk us through, you know, just a different stages, you know, from in utero, pregnancy onward, how that microbiome starts to form?
Absolutely. So the fun thing about babies as a test model is that they don't do very much, right? When you go walk, you know, from your office to your car, you've touched so many different surfaces, you're maybe eating a snack and you're touching your phone, you're doing all sorts of things. But you think about a baby in utero, it's stuck there. And so your first microbiome is coming. We don't actually really know. And one of the biggest challenges that I've seen in papers is there's such a high risk of contamination when you're doing a biopsy of amniotic fluid or something else. It's not even entirely clear, are there microbes in the sort of amniotic fluid and stuff? But let's say there are. Then you've got two sources. You can be getting it through the umbilical cord from your mother's blood, right? Because that's basically your source of everything in utero. Or up through the vaginal tract, you could be getting microbes sort of like surrounding inside the entire uterus, right? Fine. So those are your two sources when you're preborn, you're a fetus. Then when you pass through the birth canal, you definitively pick up a whole host of microbes through, you know, all that goop. And then, so that's one source that's covering your skin. But the baby actually swallows a lot, right? As they're going through, as they're being born, they swallow not just the vaginal tract fluids, but also fecal matter. And it's a direct, you know, fecal transplant. So that's their starter biome. And then your skin biome is, you know, your mom's holding you on her chest, skin to skin, you're picking up microbes right away. And then it's everything, you know, for once you're born, you're getting bacterial influences from the air around you, from all the surfaces you touch, what kinds of clothes you're wearing. But your gut biome for your first 6 months is being fed almost exclusively by either breast milk or formula. Right, so those first 6 months are actually a beautiful, from a scientific perspective, period. Because we don't need to know, like, is it the Mediterranean diet or whatever else? You're drinking breast milk. It's the breast milk diet. So that's what we got. And so you have very limited influences. And what that really shows us, because you could take babies that are pure formula fed or pure breast milk fed, and they have wildly different microbiomes, not just between those two groups, but even within those groups. So it's already showing us that still the air the baby's breathing, you know, when 5% of your gut microbiome comes from your mother's nipple skin, if you're breastfeeding, I think it's maybe even more than that, you know, so it's all these little influences. And then it continues to get more complex from there. But basically everything you touch or eat.
Yeah, and I have so many questions around that. So if a woman has C-section versus vaginal delivery, what is the impact on the baby's microbiome?
So there's a distinct impact on it. The bigger question is, so we know this to be true. We know that babies who are born by C-section, right, the first thing they're touching, they're not touching the vaginal fluid. So they're touching the doctor's, hopefully, sterile gloves. But you know, nothing is ever truly sterile, right? Because there's microbes in the air. And then they're touching, you know, maybe immediately the mother's skin. Hopefully they're nursing right away or something like that, right? So they get this very distinct microbiomes. It's not totally clear, though, that that's like a, you know, a one-way ticket to health or not health. It definitely is going to influence it, but immediately it starts to get, you know, impacted by, okay, are you breastfeeding? Are you doing other things, right? So we cannot, I don't want to say use the word fix it, but the how much that one thing matters immediately starts to degrade in importance. So one thing, but another challenge of C-sections is that you're on intravenous antibiotics. I think that's probably the bigger issue of a C-section. And I want to be very clear, 10% of women used to die in childbirth. So people should not avoid C-sections if they need a C-section, right? That always needs to be stated, because we shouldn't be insane. Have the baby, survive the birth, and then we can deal with the rest of it. But yeah, you're taking intravenous antibiotics, which are definitely shifting that your biome, the baby's biome.
Yeah, and exactly. I think just the awareness, though, that it has an impact. Like you said, then you may use other ways to strengthen your baby's microbiome, knowing that, you know, some women, for example, can also nurse, some women can't breastfeed for one reason or another. And there are many paths to helping your child. And on that topic, how much of that baby's microbiome is formed in the first 6 months, or say in the first couple years, and how malleable and adaptable is it I know certainly to adults, we still say the microbiome is still very adaptable. So I know throughout life it is. But how much of an imprint, if you will, did those first 6 months or however long in that early time period make?
So without sounding alarmist or anything like that, I think that what the studies show is that you could have very different experiences in your first year of life. And then when you shift to eating solid foods and you're a three-year-old toddler, everyone's microbiomes maybe look exactly the same. The challenge, though, is it's not cumulative exactly. I mean, for me, a good analogy is, you know how babies are open to, your brain is open to learning any kind of language. And then your ears start to decide, oh, we speak Japanese. Oh, we speak English. And they sort of like close, your brain closes off to other types of sounds, right? And so there's a critical window of language development. And so what language you're hearing in your window of language development, you'll always be more attuned to Japanese or more attuned to French, right? And it's kind of like that with your microbiome. The microbiome and your immune system that's happening at critical phases of development can sort of cause certain diseases or not, right? And then you can pass through that phase. And you might, you know, then after that, everyone's taking French class and we all learn French, but there's still this difference, because at that critical window of development, there was a difference. Does that make sense? I know I kind of mixed two analogies there, but I think that's really what we're learning is, and so I'll give you a very specific example, is that they showed that Russian babies, you know, there's one great study that showed that Finnish babies and Russian babies, genetically very similar populations, in the first 6 months had altered, you know, slightly different microbiomes. The Finnish kids end up with 6x the rate of type 1 diabetes. Huge differences in food allergies. But then by 2 years, their microbiomes look the same, right? So it's in this phase of development that there was a difference in how their immune system was interacting with their microbiome, and it causes a potentially lifelong disease. Right? There's no coming back from type 1 diabetes today, anyway. I would say that we should all be doing more to do the best we can, right? We cannot control everything. I can't control the amount of air pollution in the air in Philadelphia. But even with that, there are a lot of choices we could be making to try and, in these critical phases, you know, protect our babies as much as possible.
Yeah. And, you know, as a parent, and I'm sure as a lot of people listening who have infants or are contemplating having them, you know, the natural question is, what are things that we should strive to do? And of course, you know, life doesn't always work out as we hope or plan. But
exactly. But
what are ideal? What's the ideal of things that if everything worked out as we hope and envision that we should do?
Yeah, I think we know from certain populations that have some really, really low rates of chronic illness that are sort of childhood onset. One thing, again, protect your infant skin barrier. One of the things that I think about a lot is the baby is born, whether vaginally or C-section, they're born in what's covered in what's called a vernix caseosa. And it's kind of gross looking. They look like a weird, like, white goblin. But really, in all of Europe now, it's recommended you do not wash your baby for 4 weeks, because that is a protective layer that seeds that baby's microbiome. It just covers them in like the thickest emollient possible, basically, for 4 weeks while their skin is maturing, and just leave it there. There's no reason to wash them. They're clean, right? But we, even with my elder son, I remember like watching the nurse like scrub each limb. And I'm not saying that one thing caused his eczema. I'm just saying that didn't help, right? So we protect the baby's skin as much as possible. Keep as many chemicals off of your baby's skin as you can. And that includes the diapers, that includes the wipes, that includes the baby baths, it includes all of it, right? So as much as you can, pure water, clean water. Ideally, for the first month and 2 months, if you can, breastfeed. I understand that's not going to work for everybody. Fed is best, but that's in that before vaccines kick in and stuff, that's a really critical window to sort of, again, seed the baby's gut with sugars that are only found in breast milk. So breastfeed if you can early. That's a big thing to the early microbiome. After they start eating foods, make sure they're eating a healthy diet, no sugar, right? All the things that are going to up your levels of, stay away from everything that's going to cause you to jump up in fungus growth and, you know, the high fiber vegetables, right? The same stuff we did as adults. So there's your skin and your gut. And And your last big barrier, which is, you know, their barrier organs are what's covered in the microbiome, is your lungs. And that's about clean air, exposure to, you know, to dirt and good trees. Again, we don't really get to control our air quality, unfortunately. So we do the best we can. In terms of, I think the single thing everyone can do in their home, make sure there's no mold, right? You're not smoking around the baby. Anything that you could be doing that's like making things worse, let's not do that. Right? But we can't, I mean, again, I don't get to pick how close I live to Route 95.
Right, exactly. And in terms of time windows, you mentioned if you're breastfeeding, certainly if you can do a month or two, that's a really critical time. How about for, you mentioned not exposing the child to chemicals, i.e. like maybe diapers and wipes. That's obviously very hard to do. As a parent of three children, I needed diapers. It was very...
Sorry, I should have clarified. There are more chemically diapers and more chemically wipes. So choose, use diapers and wipes. Your baby needs to have a clean bottom. I meant try and use, I should have been more clear. I apologize. Use the least chemically, least, you know, I remember... You know, one of the things we did with wipes for our kids is, you know, just using like a washcloth that was just soaked in water. And that's a great way for, especially a lot of like just the pee diapers, like they don't need a massively chemical wipe to clean them off. You know, there's a lot of times where you could just, even if it's now you're down to the wipes 10% of the time, fine. Right. But like less is more in that sense.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that that's very doable because you're home a lot of times and, can maybe save the wipes for when there's more than pee.
Exactly. Yeah. I could get it. You get the super gross poop diapers. You need to get in there.
And as baby is growing into infant, what are things parents can continue to do?
You know, I think that's really kind of as they transition past a year. So we know, again, I mentioned early allergen introduction earlier. We know that as soon as a baby can tolerate solid foods, they should be eating. They should be training tolerance to all of the foods, as many foods, ideally as diverse of a diet as possible, but definitely the foods they're going to eat as an adult, right? So an important thing to remember is that people tend to not develop allergies either if they aggressively eat the foods in infancy or nobody in their environment is eating the foods, right? So the problem happens when the adults are eating foods and the baby's not, because then the baby's getting skin exposure to foods, because every food creates a ton of dust. And so then you're getting skin exposure, but you're not getting oral exposure. So you want to match, I should say, the skin exposure and the gut exposure. So get them a diverse diet. But then as soon as they're like walking, you know, honestly, it's like treating them like adults. They should get sun, fresh air, exercise, a healthy diet. That's mostly vegetables. It's right from there, right? I mean, that's 90% of all health. Wouldn't you agree?
I couldn't agree more, but you make it sound so simple and it's just so hard.
I know. I know. It's like every time I take my kids to Costco, right? And then they're like, but mom, why can't I have this?
Yeah, exactly.
And they get a lecture in the aisle. I'm like, I just explained. We don't want the candida to grow. We want to support the bacteroides. And they're like, okay, just forget it.
Oh, goodness. Yes, I can relate. And so the impact, so, you know, we're talking about how, you know, helping the microbiome early in life can make a difference. And you've mentioned how it can impact, you know, immune health. What are other ways that may manifest in a child, in their overall health, their performance? Like, are there any other ways that it's really vital or critical to work on the microbiome?
Well, so I focus a lot in the book on thinking about how our immune system, you know, malfunctions and how then our immune system creates these self-diseases. Some of the most difficult to deal with, honestly, are sort of like psychosocial disorders that can be created. And it's not totally clear what's going on there, right? So we know, for example, a shift in the gut biome and your gut-brain axis can dramatically increase your rates of ADHD. There's a lot of belief now that autism, for example, is an immune disease. We see these T cells inside the brain inside the brain tissue of people with autism. That's not the case in people without. It's not totally clear what's the causal pathway there, like exactly what happened to cause that. So I'm not going to pretend I understand that. Maybe somebody out there does. I'll give you the example of my son. When he was around five. And before we really started and took to heart sort of dealing with his potentially microbial issues in his gut, he used to have these horrible tantrums multiple times a day, just really bad. And what really shocked me out of my complacency around it was when he started to think of himself as a bad person. He said to me one day something like, well, it doesn't matter because I'm just a bad kid. And I was like, no, you're not a bad kid. Like, I've seen you at your best, and I know that that kid is a real kid too, right? And I was like, we can't, like, because once you think of yourself as a bad person, right, you let everything go,
right?
Right? And I was like, no, like, this is not okay. And, you know, we started seeing a naturopathic physician, a functional medicine physician, and did a lot of work around sort of resetting his microbiome. And the tantrums just disappeared. I can't explain to you the number of family members, friends in the neighborhood were like, wow, he's such a cool dude now. He's so chill, you know? And he thinks of himself now as a person who can learn, who can deal with stress. You know, before he probably would have just thrown a book in the air and been like, I'm not a reader. And now he's someone who's like, okay, I didn't get it the first time, I'm going to try again. And to me, he can have his eczema, he can have his food allergies, but if you think of yourself as a bad person, that's a horrible way to live. And that was everything to me.
Oh, I can completely understand. And I think that self-identity kind of carries through a lot of the choice and decisions that children and even into adulthood people make.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned you went to naturopath and you started working on his microbiome. So he was five at this time. What were the types of things that you started doing that led to the turnaround?
He was a little bit older, actually. And honestly, what triggered that whole thing was we tried oral immunotherapy. And we tried oral immunotherapy and it went horribly awry. It not only didn't work for us, which it works for a lot of people, so I'm not saying don't try it. It didn't work for us, but it actually induced allergies to wheat and soy in him. Like, his immune system got so upset. So it was after that I was like, there's just a deeper issue we really, really have to deal with. And so that was the trigger for that. And so what he did really was, you know, he did a gut biome test, but he was like, I don't know. Like, as you know this well, right? There's like a lot of microbiomes that are in the okay range. And people react differently. So we kind of started on a treatment of, he's like, let's try sort of controlling some of this fungal growth that's clear in his stool and some other things. And so we took some supplements around sort of reducing that. And then a couple of probiotics to sort of increase, now that we were creating some space where we killed off the fungus, to maybe, you know, seed it with some more helpful bacteria. And then it was some other diet changes, you know, really, really the diet changes around being aggressive about the no sugar in our house. The, you know, eating clean, making sure we were really aggressive about, he's just wildly sensitive to like chemicals and foods and stuff like that. And so we just had to be hyper clean. And it really made a huge difference for him. You know, he's like, he's really sensitive to these like emulsifiers and additives in a way that the rest of us just aren't.
Yeah. How long did it take for you to start to notice a difference?
I mean, the effects were like immediate. Like, we did all this stuff and it was like in a week, we were like, who is this kid? You know, and the entire family's like stress levels were just, you know, you don't even remember what it feels like to stand up straight when you've been feeling so beaten down, you know, but you know, we've kept it up, honestly. Like, we've let some stuff back into his diet. He's allowed some ice pops and things like that, but we test it, right? So sometimes we'll try something. Like, there are some preservatives that we tried and he had like pain, gas, you know, that sorts of stuff. And we're like, okay, that's not an okay one. And some things we let back in from certain kinds of grains and other stuff that he seems to tolerate. So we try our hardest to sort of expand his diet as much as possible, because he has to live in the world as well, right? And I don't want to unnecessarily restrict things, but it does, you know, we are seeing this healing. Like, his skin is better. He's just more resistant. He's more resistant to illness. He's more, you know, just overall, like, it seems like this, it's been about 2 years, I would say, now for him.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. If, you know, for the parents listening, if there's one thing you wish that all parents knew, is what would you say that was?
I wish parents knew that the current statistics are that your child has a 40 to 50% chance of developing a chronic immune issue if they're born today. And nobody is really grappling with the fact that that's how high the risk is. And if you knew the risk was that high, you would be taking steps to prevent these things. So I think we really need to grapple with the level of this epidemic. You know, what are the actual odds here? Because we all go into pregnancy and birth being like, that's not going to be me, yeah, right? But if it's not food allergies, it's going to be asthma, or it's going to be eczema, or it's going to be ADHD, or it's going to be, you know, God forbid, one of the more chronic autoimmune diseases that are even harder to control. But the lives our children live are going to be wild, very distinct from the ones that we got to live. And I think that should be motivating us to think about, you know, think about how we feed and care for our babies. Like, maybe we have to do some steps to counteract this, and that's okay. Often the childcare stuff is actually less work. Like I said, you know, it's like, it's a much shorter bath time routine if you just rinse them with some water and put pajamas on. It's less work. And so we can actually do less in some ways and be better off.
Yeah. And in your book, you know, you talk through some of the things parents can do. Would you say, like you said, not bathing a kid is actually pretty easy. How hard would you say it is to make these changes as a parent who, you know, really made a pretty big change in your child's life? How hard was it for you to do that?
Everything other than the food was easy, because it's mostly like a not this, that, you know, or this, not that, whatever that website is or something. You know, it's like not this product, just this other one, but you're still using product, right? I would say the food was the hardest because thankfully, in some ways, we started all this during COVID when we weren't allowed to go out. And so it was super easy to control his diet. And we were cooking at home. So we were cooking at home. No big deal, right? It's really easy to eat well when you cook at home. The challenge is like once the birthday parties start and everything else, and we just have had such a cultural obsession with sugar and garbage, you know, Here's all these snacks and whatever. And fighting American culture is the single hardest thing. And our culture is very wrapped up in sugar as a reward for everything.
Yeah. And, you know, again, being someone who does adult medicine, I would echo that. I think sugar is kind of the downfall of adult health as well. So it does parents just as much good as it does for the children to eliminate that sugar in the family.
Yeah, absolutely. We didn't put on our COVID-15 or whatever because we weren't good. You can't eat celery. You can't eat vegetables to a point you'll put on weight like that. It's not possible.
And meanwhile, if people want to find out more about the book and learn more about how to take care of their baby and their microbiome, how can they get more information?
There's a ton of information and actually a podcast where, you know, there's a lot of interviews. You can hear it directly from the people who did the research, but it's like a very limited, just like 7 or 8 episodes. It's on fixingsick.com. And there's a link to pre-order the book and a whole ton of other information, short reads and things like that on fixingsick.com. It's a great way to learn a bunch.
That's great. And we'll attach it to the show notes so people will be able to access it. So, Meenal, thank you so much for all the information you've shared. This has just been fascinating. And thank you for, I think, being so mission-driven. I think a lot of times people go through an experience, they're, you know, frustrated, upset, and you really channel that into something that can hopefully impact so many other children and parents who have to, you know, coach their children through a lot of the challenges that you had to coach your child through. So thank you for putting so much of yourself into, you know, creating a book and something that captures all the hard work and research you did in a way that's shareable. That's really a gift.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate that. I that is the motivating factor, right? Like, I can't go back. I can't fix history for my son. But if every single one of my cousins or friends doesn't have to go through this, then that's all, you know, it's all worth it then.
Yeah, fabulous. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
The Whole Health Cure is brought to you by the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center at Emory. For more information about wellness assessments, classes, and other resources, please visit our website. This material is copyrighted by Emory University.